May it please the court. Good afternoon. My name is John Bradley, registration number 10143 on behalf of the appellant plaintiff, Dr. Richard Remark. Dr. Remark is with me this afternoon, and I'd also like to introduce my co-counsel associate, Leslie German. Her registration number is 40901. In this particular instance, I think it's unique from my review of cases. I'm not here that often, but there's not a lot of argument about the law that applies in this case because of the procedural status of it. There's just going to be, I suspect, significant argument of how to apply the allegations of the complaint against that law. As I'm sure the panel knows, Your Honors, this case is here because the trial court granted a motion to dismiss on all of the plaintiff's six claims for relief. The first two claims, actually all claims, breach of contract, promissory estoppel, breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, intentional interference with contract, and interference with a business opportunity and civil conspiracy were all dismissed based against most of the defendants based on the court's conclusion that the contract didn't have any ambiguity in it. There's another little novelty, and that's the immunity issue, which is academically pretty interesting and stimulating, but I would like to address it last simply because it affects the least number of claims. It's only the civil conspiracy claim, the tort claim, that's asserted against Montrose Memorial Hospital. So I'd like to start off arguing about the key issue, and that is whether or not the contract has ambiguity. First, by way of background, Dr. Remark was a very successful principal in a radiology practice in Las Vegas, Nevada. And the hospital in Montrose, Montrose Memorial Hospital, suffered a complete loss of its radiologists. They went elsewhere, and they went on a headhunting mission to try and find a qualified radiologist to reestablish their radiology department. It was important for the operation of that hospital. They needed someone who could read the films, someone who could work with the orthopedists, the neurologists, the oncologists, and read the films so that people could get appropriate treatment and care. So everything about this case really was about bringing in a highly qualified professional like Dr. Remark to get that department up and running. There was negotiations, and based upon those negotiations, a contract was entered into between the hospital and Dr. Remark. He left that practice, which was highly lucrative and successful for him, for the challenge of coming to Montrose and establish that department. But it was important for him to know that before he came and abandoned what he had going for him in Las Vegas, that he had certain assurances in that contract, and they were negotiated, particularly a 7-year term, and secondly, at least at the outset, an 18-month guarantee of his income of a minimum of $700,000 a year, plus another $5,000 a month to establish the radiology department. After 3 months, that contract was terminated, and he was left out on the street looking for other work. And I know that sounds kind of harsh for someone who's making the kind of income Dr. Remark is making, but he left behind his family and his home in Las Vegas for the opportunity presented to him by Montrose Memorial Hospital. So the issue comes down to whether or not this contract has an ambiguity, because it has a clause in there allowing either party to terminate it on 90 days. As you've seen in the complaint, Dr. Remark asserted that that somehow got in there unbeknownst to him without his knowledge, but be that as it may, it's there, and the parties executed the contract. But it has other clauses that are mutually exclusive and clearly ambiguous with that 90-day termination clause. First, there's the clause, which you can find at paragraph 2.01, which is an income guarantee. Now, initially, that was only for 18 months, but if there's a 90-day termination clause, what if after 3 months, the hospital decides to terminate? Is that 18-month guarantee still applicable? It doesn't matter that it was after 30 months, because in the meantime, they'd extended it to a 7-year guarantee. So you can ask yourselves, if it was applicable at the beginning for 18 months, after the renegotiation, it was still applicable for 7 years. In addition, paragraph 4.02 of the contract has a 7-year term. That's mutually exclusive with a 90-day termination clause. Typically, and I'm sure your honors can take notice, contracts you see that have a termination clause like that don't have a defined term. And finally, it's mostly exclusive and mutually exclusive with the renegotiated term that occurred on May 20th, 2008. It was Exhibit B to the plaintiff's complaint, and it has no contingencies to it. Paragraph 1 says, MMH will extend salary guarantee for entire period of current radiology contract with a 3% cost of living adjustment, or COLA adjustment, 7 years guaranteed. So clearly that's contrary to a 90-day termination clause. This doesn't have any contingencies in it.
Bradley, can I ask you a question on based on what you said so far?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Why isn't it just as likely an interpretation to say that the salary guarantee applies for the term that the parties choose? And if the term that the parties choose is only 30 months or 36 months or 72, why isn't the salary guarantee simply applicable to that?
Well, because the salary guarantee in paragraph 2.1 specifically only is contingent upon performance of part three of the contract, which is him doing a good job as a doctor. It's not contingent on anything else. In addition, if they were to agree that it was terminable on 90 days, then the 7-year guarantee is pure surplusage. It's superfluous.
Why would it be superfluous if the contract, in fact, runs for 7 years? If the parties mutually perform their obligations under the contract, he's certain to get particular salary for that entire term, and it can't be changed.
Correct. That guarantees the salary for the 7 years. I understand your argument exactly, Your Honor. The part that's inconsistent and ambiguous is if he's coming here counting on and depending on a negotiated term of 7 years with a minimum salary, a 90-day termination clause is totally inconsistent with that. That way he doesn't get the 7 years.
Doesn't that require that we simply ignore the 90-day termination provision? And how can we do that?
I don't think it needs to be ignored, Your Honor. In our reply brief, we set out 5 different ways that this contract with these ambiguous contracts could be interpreted. First, that, well, I don't want to state, but first, the first interpretation is that the 7-year salary guarantee must be paid regardless of any other provisions in the contract, including the 90 days. A second equally readable proportion is that the contract allows for the services of Dr. Remark to be terminated, but the salary guarantee must be continued. And that's like a no-cut contract for a football player or a basketball player or a coach. And we even cited the case in Colorado where that's the case. They can terminate his services, but they still owe him the salary guarantee because it's guaranteed. The third interpretation is the one that you're suggesting, Your Honor, is that the termination provision of the contract cancels the salary guarantee and or its term. But if you're going to ignore one clause of the contract, why pick that one? If you choose to employ the 90-day termination clause, then you are ignoring the other clauses of the contract that I suggested, that being the 7-year term and the 7-year salary guarantee. So in order to apply one, you have to ignore the other. So to argue my side of the case or my client's side of the case, you do have to perhaps argue the 90-day or ignore the 90-day termination clause. But to apply the 90-day termination clause, you would have to ignore the 7-year term and the 7-year guarantee. And that is the nub, the essence of ambiguity that's left for the trier of fact, rather than to be determined as a matter of law. One way or another, something has to be ignored. The only way that it can be interpreted where you apply both clauses is the one that I suggested, like the athlete, where he gets his 7-year guarantee, but they can send him on his way. That applies both clauses equally and equally with force and power. Did I answer your question adequately?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. The reason I'm arguing and focusing my attention on the ambiguity is because all the claims fell like dominoes once the court concluded that the contract was not ambiguous and it could be terminated on 90 days' notice. And I would suggest to your honors that in the court's order, the fatal flaw in that conclusion is found on page 7 of the judge's order. The judge says, and I won't quote at length, but it'll point out the fatal flaw in the court's analysis. Contrary to the plaintiff's position, the salary guarantee and the termination clause are not mutually exclusive. While the agreement guarantees a certain amount of net collections and a 3% annual COLA for the entire 7-year term of the contract, it also allows either party to terminate the agreement unilaterally with 90 days written notice. And the last phrase is the one that I'd like to draw your attention to. In other words, MMH was obligated to provide a certain salary for 7 years unless the agreement was properly terminated. The only way that the district court judge was able to reconcile these two was to add language that's not in the contract. The easy solution for this contract would have been salary guaranteed unless terminated, or that the salary doesn't have to be paid if the contract's terminated. It's silent in that regard. And the only way that the district court judge was absolutely able to reconcile these clearly ambiguous clauses was by to shove language into the contract that's not there. There's nowhere in that contract where it says unless the agreement was properly terminated. And just as a sidebar here, it's important to recognize that Dr. Remark wasn't terminated for cause. It was political. It was something else. We don't know what it was because we haven't had discovery yet. But there's a clear correspondence from the hospital's representative that it was not for cause. I see I'm down almost 5 minutes, so absent any other questions regarding the ambiguity, I've argued in the brief that there's five clearly equal ways to interpret the contract. One that I like particularly is a year and a half later after the contract, the Blue Cross Blue Shield deal was done and additional consideration was granted to extend the 18-month guarantee to 7 years. So that's a subsequent contract that modifies any possible termination clause. That extension has no contingencies in it whatsoever. Finally, with regard to the immunity question, I would simply suggest to the court that the contract itself clearly indicates that the hospital believes that it needs radiology, it needs a radiology department, it needs a radiologist to put it together. What Dr. Remark does is read films for the mammography department, for the oncologists, for the neurologists, for the orthopedists, for every department. They need a radiologist, and so that is clearly the provision of healthcare to the public. Even though this contract dispute right now is over the termination clause, the general action surrounds and the other pre-existing claims have to do with terminating his provisions as a physician. And he was no longer able to conduct his medical practice there and support the hospital's needs when it came to serving the needs of these patients. At the very least, the court should have asked for and allowed us a Trinity hearing to explore that. As a conclusion remark before I sit down, I would like to reserve 3 minutes. I would simply suggest to the court that the standard and that the law argued by both sides is the same. The court, in this particular instance, with a motion to dismiss, is to take the allegations of the complaint asserted as true and look at them in a light most favorable to the plaintiff. We've asserted the allegations that clearly put this dispute as one that should go to the trier of fact. What did that contract mean? There's no easy way to reconcile these completely disparate clauses, and I would suggest that's what the trier's of fact responsibility would be. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Andrew Ringel. My attorney registration number is 24762. I'm here on behalf of the appellees. I wanted to follow up on some of the issues that were raised in Mr. Bradley's argument. I agree with Mr. Bradley that the important part of the district court's opinion respecting the breach of contract claim is page 7, and unless it's properly terminated. I disagree with Mr. Bradley that somehow the district court creating an additional term to reconcile the terms of the contract. I think as Judge Casepold indicated, one can read the two provisions together without doing any harm to the two provisions and reading them appropriately, meaning the guarantee and the term provisions along with the termination provisions. I think it's important to note that in section 4.02, there are six different ways in which the contract could have been terminated by either party. Some of them apply to only one party, some apply to both parties. The three that I think are important is mutual agreement is one. The last one is subsection F, which is what's at issue in this case, the 90-day provision that's bilateral. It's a bilateral, unilateral provision. In other words, either Dr. Remark or the hospital could have terminated it by providing 90 days notice to the other. The other one that I wanted to talk to the court about was the provision that, which is subsection E, having to do with the circumstances of the contract being terminated in the event of Dr. Remark passing away or being incapacitated with a long-term disability of greater than 90 days. The logic of the plaintiff's argument in this case would mean that if that any of those six termination provisions, including subsection E related to if in the event of Dr. Remark passing away, would still trigger the 7-year guarantee provision, and that is an argument that makes no sense. I think the district court got it right when the district court analyzed the issue by saying that you can look at these, and so long as the term of the contract existed, if it was not appropriately terminated under one of the six provisions of 4.02, then the salary guarantee existed. The other implication of the plaintiff's argument is it's essentially trying to make it into a no-cut contract when it has a termination provision. The implications of that would be that under any circumstances where you have a contract that has a term and it has some kind of set compensation provision in the contract, no termination provision in that contract would be enforceable. And that's not the law in the state of Colorado. Colorado contracts, even in this kind of personal services context, or even in an employment context, allow it to be terminated with an appropriate termination provision. Under the logic of the plaintiff's argument, even a termination for cause wouldn't be appropriate, and counsel for the plaintiff is correct. There was not a termination of cause in this instance, but under the provision of 4.02, one of those provisions is a for cause termination, or the functional equivalent of it, if you will. And under the logic of the plaintiff's argument, that wouldn't be appropriate. I'm not going to belabor the issue unless the court and unless any of you have questions about the breach of contract. I can move on to some of the other arguments. Hearing none, let me go on to the Colorado governmental immunity argument. I think the issue under the Colorado governmental immunity argument is twofold. The first issue is the notion that somehow the district court erred by not holding a Trinity hearing in the case. As we argued in the briefs, and as this court is familiar from the Supreme Court's Padilla versus School District Number 1 decision and Trinity itself, if there are not disputed issues of jurisdictional fact, there is no need for a Trinity hearing, and the court in this instance concluded there weren't any issues of jurisdictional fact. The thing that is interesting to me about the argument now that there was a problem in not holding the Trinity hearing, the plaintiff has argued consistently that the plaintiff wanted a Trinity hearing in this case, but one of the things that has been absent from any presentation by the plaintiff is any assertion of what jurisdictional facts would have been presented to the court below to demonstrate that this was within the 2410-106-1B exception of operation of a public hospital. What appears to have been relied upon is the notion that this is just the operations of a public hospital because Dr. Remark is a radiologist, and among the other services that he provides at the hospital are patient care services, medical services as a radiologist. I think that the Tenth Circuit's decision in Craven, this court's decision in Awad, and this court's decision in Daly all stand for the proposition that there needs to be more of a nexus between the issues involved and the direct purpose of the public facility at issue, and in this case, a public hospital. What we have here is a dispute involving an alleged breach of contract and related tort claims about the services that Dr. Remark was going to provide to the hospital. Those kind of things have only a tangential or an ancillary relationship to the purpose of the operation of public hospital, i.e. medical care, surgical care for the sick and injured.
So, Mr. Bell, is it your position that if a physician enters into a contract with a patient and provides in the contract some terms and conditions, and then the physician breaches that, resulting in damages to the injured patient, that's not a public operation, or it is a public operation?
Well, I think several points. One, if it's a breach of contract claim, it's outside the Governmental Immunity Act altogether because it doesn't lie in tort, right? So it would be with outside the parameters of the Governmental Immunity Act. But I think that under the Sereff case, you know, the which is this court's case and decision in Sereff versus Waldman, which involved the residency program at Swedish that was done in conjunction with the residency program at Denver Health, which was the public entity overlay to it. The resident in that case allegedly committed malpractice in the actual patient care to a specific patient in that case, you know, tragically resulting in the death of somebody and a lawsuit as a result. This court held in that case that that the provision of medical services was within the context of an operation of a public hospital, and therefore immunity was waived under 2410-1061B. The distinction that I'm trying to draw between that circumstance and the one that you just raised, Judge Casebolt, is that what we have here has only the only reason that it's related to the operation of a hospital is the mere fact that Dr. Remark is a doctor, and the mere fact that he was providing he provides as a doctor patient care services at the hospital. It's much more like in this case the decisions in Craven and Awad and Daly that are ancillary to the circumstances of the operation of a hospital. Similarly to, you know, in the Craven decision, the Tenth Circuit looked at this court's decision in Flores versus Colorado Department of Corrections and Pack versus Arkansas Valley Correctional Facility, and distinguished between the Flores case, which held that under the same provision, albeit applicable to correctional facilities, that a slip and fall in the correctional parking lot was not a waiver, but in PAC, a slip and fall in the visitor's room of the correctional facility was waived because the operation of a correctional facility has to do with rehabilitation, and visiting is part and parcel of the purpose of a correctional facility. And the distinction that the Tenth Circuit drew in Craven and this court then drew in Awad is that the alleged injury must be directly related to the purpose of the public institution as distinct from its simple operation. And I think what we have here is it's a simple operation of a public hospital, and as a result, it's not within the waived area. The other claims, the other four claims, are effectively derivative of the breach of contract and the, well, essentially a breach of contract claim. We have a promissory estoppel argument, and as this court said in the Wheat Ridge Urban Renewal Authority case that we've cited in the briefs, you can't have both a breach of contract and a promissory estoppel claim in the context of where you have an express breach of contract. That's what the district court decided in this case, and that's correct. In terms of the breach of implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, the district court held that because the hospital relied on the specific termination provision, it was faithful to the expectations under the agreement, and therefore there wasn't such a claim. As we argue in the brief, I think there's a real question about whether a breach of implied covenant in good faith and fair dealing exists in this context because of the Supreme Court's determination that it doesn't exist in the employment contract context. I understand that this is not an employee-employee relationship, and the contract specifically says that and states it. It's essentially a personal services agreement, but I would submit that the same logic that exists in the Decker case, for instance, and the United States District Court's decision in Marsh versus Delta Airlines indicates that you wouldn't have the existence of a breach of implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing case claim in this context. In terms of the two intentional interference cases, the district court is clearly right in saying that neither Quorum or Mr. Hample could have interfered with a contract in an improper way if the hospital was appropriately exercising its rights under the termination provision. And so because there is no breach of contract, there obviously can't be an interference with contract claim or even an interference with prospective business advantage claim, although frankly, I don't know how that claim works in this context because there are no allegations of any interference with anything other than the contract that was between the hospital and Dr. Remark. And then the last claim is the civil conspiracy claim. With respect to Quorum and Mr. Hampel, there can't be an unlawful overt act if it was appropriate to terminate the contract. That's the predicate event that plaintiff is relying upon, and as a result of that, because there is no breach of contract here, there can't be a conspiracy claim as well. I don't have anything further for the court unless the court has any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court. Judge Casewell, the question you asked before, I think, really is the nub of what we're here for today. It was also asserted by Mr. Rinkel that these two clauses, or actually several clauses in the contract, can be read together in a way that doesn't do harm to the contract. And I would suggest to the court that it takes a strained interpretation of the contract not to see that these clauses are ambiguous. He said that it's unusual, or it would render moot any kind of termination clause if there was a 7-year guarantee. You could take judicial notice, I'm sure, of all the contracts that you've seen. It's unusual to have both a guaranteed term and a guaranteed salary for that term. Again, it's very much like the no-cut contract that we've argued. And that is mutually exclusive of a 90-day termination clause. That there's no way they can be read together that makes any sense. There's five interpretations that we've come up with, most of which support the plaintiff's version of this case. 2.01, the income guarantee is only contingent upon performance by the doctor. 4.02 says it's a 7-year guaranteed term. In addition, Exhibit B makes it a guaranteed salary for that entire term, and that was renegotiated nearly 2 years after this contract was initially signed. Bringing those terms together in any way without one at the exclusion of the other is nearly impossible, unless you read that he gets the 7 years even if he is still there or not, if they terminate the contract. Otherwise, as you suggested, what would the point of the 90-day termination clause be? The mirror image of that question is, what's the point of the combination of a 7-year term and a 7-year guarantee? Well, the point is, Dr. Remark left an existing valuable practice, making a substantial income, put that all behind him, wouldn't take that risk without the 7-year guarantee and without the income guarantee. And that's what's asserted in the complaint, and that's what you have to take as asserted as true in a light most favorable to the plaintiff. So clearly, the 7-year guarantee and the 7-year term are crucial elements to Dr. Remark. Even the defendants in this case, in their brief, in order to argue that those are not inconsistent, In page 5 of Mr. Riggle's brief, he inserts language that's not into the contract in order to try and reconcile those two clauses. And he apes and mimics, obviously, what the district court did by inserting language in there to try and bring those two together when they are inapposite. They can't be brought together. So I thank you so much for your time on behalf of Dr. Remark and on behalf of my associate, Ms. German. Absent any other questions, I'm out of time, and thank you.
Thank you for your arguments this afternoon. This case will also stand submitted. We will get you a written opinion in due course.